Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
It's a wet and rainy day in New York City. It reminded me of Glasgow yesterday for the Betfred Scottish League Cup final, which was such a throwback game, Andrew. There's going to be a Scottish team throughout this podcast.
Really?
I hope you can pick up on it. Yesterday's game was just brilliant. It was a throwback. Muddy field, lashing rain, missed penalties, controversy, no VAR. Wonderful.
Why are missed penalties, that's a throwback?
Well, it was a save.
Is there a time when penalties were more routinely missed than what we see now?
No, it was just the drama of it, I suppose.
Okay.
And, well, it wasn't missed. It was saved by Fraser Forster, who really putting behind his spell at Southampton.
It's all just yet another window into how you hate today's game and wish that we could go back to the days.
No. Although, I'll be going back to 1995 later in the podcast. Yeah. I hope people
This
enjoy
is
it.
What we do, though. We romanticize, like, every generation believes that, you know, things were better back in their day. You're not even old enough to really be able to do that, but you're such an old soul that you have romanticized the sport of your youth.
And
despised the sport of today, whereas kids who are growing up today will do the same thing in 20 years. Like, this is all very predictable.
Yeah, I've romanticized football between the years of 1992 and 2002 to an extreme degree. I don't deny that. There was bad things then, and there was terrible matches then.
Of course.
But I look back, because I guess it's the years you fall in love with the game.
Mm-hmm. It's like I just wish you could see that, and I don't have to remind you every week that you've become just a grouch.
Am I going that way?
Yes. 100%.
No joy in my life.
From my vantage point, that's what I see.
Wow.
Yeah. Here are some of the things that JJ will pour cold water on throughout the course of the show today. Of course, the Manchester Derby. Manchester City, I'm not even going to make the joke anymore about Liverpool hoisting the trophy every time City loses, because it's not even, like, that's not even a thing worth mentioning anymore.
And it's disrespectful to Brendan.
To the real title challengers, who we'll talk about as well later on in the program, because I have an interesting question. I'm really curious to get your thoughts on it. And then somebody reached out to us last week and said that this podcast, we jumped the shark. We don't even talk about anybody below 10th in the table anymore, which is not true, because we spend a fair amount of time on Arsenal and Everton. Look, facts are facts.
Seinfeld.
But yeah, so we will have a little bit of a conversation later on in the podcast about some of our pleasant surprises of the season, which actually might involve teams that are not below 10th in the table. And therein lies the surprise. What to watch for, big Champions League, what to watch for, because this is the week where things happen and where lives change, legacies are made, careers are altered, and a mailbag. So yeah, all of that to look forward to on another Monday podcast. This is becoming more and more routine.
It's good.
I don't even know what our routine is anymore, but this is, I'm now getting to a place where I just assume, all right, Sunday night, I've got some work to do.
Well, there's some listeners who are hate the fact they never know when the pod is dropping.
I know.
But to them I say, just roll with it.
Yeah, I never know what the best way is to do. Do listeners want, like, the surprise podcast, or do they want, like, routine? This is when Caught Offside happens. I listen to them. Then on this day, I listen to this.
Well,
I don't know.
We should comment before we even begin on the amount of people. So Spotify break down your listening over the past year, and they send you your top songs and your top artists from 2019. And in terms of podcasts, lots of people listen to us on Spotify, and we were number one.
What do you mean? We were on whose chart?
On the person who listens to the podcast on their individual chart, we were number one. But there was many people where we were number one.
Gotcha.
One listener sent it in, and we were ahead of Football Weekly, that venerable podcast.
Yeah. Wow. Good for us. I'm proud of the work that we've done.
Very proud of it.
Let's talk about the Manchester Derby, JJ. 2-1 it ends. Manchester United, victors. They seem to have an odd amount of success in that building.
Yes, for sure. They pooped on the party last season.
Yeah.
And look, credit goes to you. You believe there's something happening at Manchester United. You believe there's a revival on the way. There were plenty of people who tweeted us to say, hey, maybe old Andy's got a point. I'm in the Gary Neville camp. I think there are good young players coming through. And that was evidenced at the weekend when they took City. I mean, they did that first half against City in particular.
It was like a 10-minute window where they were, not to say that they were poor throughout the rest of the match, but there was that window from like the 20th to 30th minute where they scored two, but how many more could it have been? They hit the bar. right. Within that window as well, in addition to the two goals that they scored. They had another chance. So, I mean, it really could have been four.
But we think that if we are to adjudicate that there is progress happening for Manchester United, you would say it is progress in windows. Look at that 10-minute spell against Sheffield United. They were abysmal in that game, and then it exploded. Little bit of that happened again in the derby. All this, I think this was a more consistent performance across the 90 minutes. Look, there's been a string of results against top teams that if you were to look at them in isolation, you would say, Solskjaer is doing a job here. And then we're 2 weeks out from 2-2 against Aston Villa.
You're right.
I'm in the Gary Neville camp here, that there are positives in terms of their youth players, and maybe, let's give them credit, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is doing good things.
Yeah,
but they will continue to be up and down. They're short of quality and experience to make them a more consistent side.
Yeah, I think you and I are probably a little bit closer to agreement on this than maybe however it came across on the previous podcast. Now, the proclamation that I made was that I believe that they are a true contender to be a top four team in England, and that was where you seemed to say, hold on, let's pump the brakes. I felt that way last week. I certainly feel that way now. It doesn't necessarily mean that I think, like, you can be fourth in England and still be a very flawed team. That's the nature of the league right now. So I think that's where you and I are probably a little bit closer than we even realize in how we view this Manchester United team. But there's a couple things. So I was actually at a bar in Maryland. I was down in Maryland over the weekend for my nephew's one-year-old birthday party. And we went out to lunch at this bar, and the game was on, which was nice. Jack did not let me sit in the seat where I had a clear view. It's funny how a three-year-old is just, like, suddenly the boss. Like, no, I'm sitting here. Well, who are you? You're three. But then, like, is this worthy of a fight? So then Amanda says, Andrew, just sit over there. So now I'm, like, turned around the whole time watching TV, ignoring my family, when I could have just sat in that seat, but there's Jack.
It's amazing your three-year-old has taken on my style and decided to demean you early.
But so anyway, so I'm watching the game, and I was there primarily for the second half. And here's the thing with United that stood out to me from maybe other versions of United, whether that be this season at points or previous seasons. But so Manchester City, this dangerous attack-minded group, like, they're down two goals in the second half. So there's no secret as to what's going to be going down over the final 45 minutes of this game. City are going all out to score goals. And in watching the game, like, I was just so impressed with Manchester United's ability to withstand wave after wave after wave. I thought Wan-Bissaka was fantastic. Mm. Like, for such a young player, I feel like he's really rounding into truly being what people thought he could be. A lot of times United have brought in some fullbacks like Luke Shaw, whether that be through injury or just not realizing expectations. But, like, Wan-Bissaka feels like he's going to fulfill whatever promise that there was before him. Harry Maguire, another player who, like, that's a huge price tag. Most expensive defender in the world. Harry Maguire. I don't know if most people would think that. But sure enough, it feels like maybe he's starting to become the player for United that, like, it was going to take a little while for him to become. And they withstood it. Now, sure enough, City did finally get a goal. They were never going to be shut out. It is still Manchester City, albeit maybe not the form that we're quite accustomed to. But, like, when they're going all-out attack for 45 minutes, they're going to find a way through. But I was just so impressed with United and their ability to just kind of fend it off, allow City to have possession. But I don't remember all that many truly great goal-scoring opportunities for Man City in that second half.
No. I think if I was to pick three players, first of all, Marcus Rashford. And again, this sounds like the kind of stuff Paul Merson would come out with on Sky Sports. But if you'll indulge me, Andrew, being a Manchester lad and understanding what it means to play against Manchester City in the derby, honestly, his performance was really great. Uh-huh. And there was a verve and a, not an anger, but a kind of a drive to it that he was like, listen, we're not letting these win. We're not letting these win.
Yeah.
He's almost like he kind of took on the soul of the fans in terms of the game. Also, Fred and McTominay in the middle of the park, probably the best outing we've seen from Fred in a long time. And having those two on it really helps that back four defend. But we need to talk about Manchester City, Andrew. And am I allowed to call myself a dumbass?
Of course. I encourage it.
All right. Well, let me do that, because I was thinking about Manchester City and their performance at the weekend and their performances over this season. And I thought back to our previews. And you ridicule me for when we did our 20 questions on the league season ahead.
Right.
For me interspersing our praise of Man City with portent of doom. And I was almost afraid to say, because City looked like such a machine last season, I was almost afraid to say the things that I said. But here are the things that I said.
This is a flashback.
Flashback. In the broad scheme of things, what I'm about to talk about here are minor worries. Would I be concerned if they haven't signed a centre-back by the end of business on Thursday? Yes, a little. But then again, when you've splashed out big money on a young and impressive defensive centre midfielder in Rodri, who can screen those centre-backs and maybe even deputise in the role, is that really a worry? Also, City's best defence is having the ball for giant periods of most games. So their defence generally isn't as pressured as other teams are. Do I love Zinchenko at left back? No, but maybe Mendy is on the mend quickly. Might the manager's win every game mentality hamper City in a third successive title search? Maybe, because he will treat the FA Cup and the Carling Cup and every other cup with the same reverence. But maybe he won't do that this season.
Carling Cup, unbelievable.
Carabao Cup, you know what I mean. The League Cup, the Rumbelows Cup, Coca-Cola Cup, all the cups. Guardiola did say last season that to be a really established team in the Champions League, they need to win more Premier Leagues. That focus shouldn't change. So all the concerns I've listed, really, left back, centre back, they're minor. What a dumbass. What the hell was I blathering on about? City left themselves in a position that they were one injury to Aymeric Laporte away from ending up with centre backs that they do, that they have no faith in. None whatsoever. John Stones, Otamendi, whatever you want. Like, why was I even being cautious in saying that? If a buffoon like me can see this in the summer, how is it Manchester City can't see this?
Well,
like, is this a blind spot for Pep Guardiola?
Well, we've always said, and you even referenced it there, the offense through defense sort of mentality. Like, well, we'll just possess the ball and that maybe will mask some of our shortcomings defensively.
Can I continue though?
Yeah.
So we talked about, it's 2 years ago now, over 2 years ago, since the collapse in the league against Liverpool, where Pep Guardiola said afterwards, we can go, you know, they equalized and then suddenly they're 2-1 down, then they're 3-1 down. And Guardiola said, we can't do this. If we have a bad moment, we can't let it, for want of a better word, metastasize into something worse. They're still doing it. This is Jonathan Wilson in The Guardian. His teams have a tendency to concede goals in clusters. On Saturday, United did not just score both their goals in the space of 6 minutes, but between the goals, Marcus Rashford hit the bar and put another good chance wide. It is as though a team so supremely drilled as City cannot quite react, cannot right itself when the mechanism begins to go awry. The club-wide tendency to blame officials and see conspiracy at every turn is probably not helpful in that regard, but that's an aside. Like, they do crumble so easily. Look at the Martial goal for 2-0. Like, Rodri, pathetic attempt at a tackle. And the next thing, Martial's in. He's falling over, not falling over. When he hits it, he doesn't hit it quite perfectly. And it scuffs in off the post. And Ederson is already heading to his right the wrong way and can't get back. They crumble. They fall apart. The same problems they had at the beginning of, or the second season of Pep's reign, still remain.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's things that have affected them when they've crashed out of Champions Leagues, which I sometimes think is the trophy that they still covet the most.
Jonathan Wilson says they phone in the league now. The league, they do their best, obviously, but they've pushed their intentions and their resources towards the Champions League. And I could not agree more with that appraisal of what they should do.
Yeah.
Just do it. Like, you know, you don't have to be the best team to win the Champions League, and you are one of the best teams in Europe in terms of personnel. The league is... it's gone.
Yeah. And fortunately for them, I think Laporte will, you know, we talk about him though sometimes. If you go back, and trust me, I have gone back and I have done this. If you watch the second leg between Tottenham and Manchester City, Laporte is the reason that City lost.
Those were mistakes. You're so right. But generally across,
I know,
the season he was.
But I'm saying he's also not infallible.
Like, no.
When we make our list, I'm trying to remember if he was included on our team of the seasons last year as our center back. I can't remember now.
Maybe.
He is good, but like...
No, Andrew, no. They are immeasurably better with him in the side.
I know. We're certain... Yes, that is now... There's no question about that because we're seeing what they are without him. So, I think it gives you a new appreciation for him. But I also wanted to mention this about Manchester City. I saw this quote from Pep, and oftentimes we try to determine whether or not this is just Pep mind games or if this is actually how he feels. Pep said this. Manchester United have the quality to defend and the quality to attack on the counterattack, and you have to accept that. That is the level we face against Liverpool, Manchester United, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Juventus. They are the teams we have to face, and the reality is maybe we are not able now to compete with them. Maybe we need to live that as a club to improve, to accept the reality now and improve. Did Pep Guardiola just slip in that Manchester City do not have the quality to compete with Manchester United?
You see, this is a trend of comments from him. We started last week with, what was it? He talked about winning. This is a slow kind of damping down of expectations so that anything then will be viewed as a success based on the position they're in right now. Remember he said, losing in society, winning can't be the only thing. This is bad for society.
Right. He's now into participation trophies.
Right. And now he's talking about this. This sounds like a man repositioning himself. A serious repositioning of the club so as to maybe do what Jonathan Wilson is suggesting and just go after the Champions League because it's arrant.
But he mentions they can't compete with Real Madrid and Barcelona and Juventus.
It's arrant nonsense. They've got more money than any of those teams. Of course they can go and compete. And a full Man City 11 can still compete with the top teams in Europe. That is just nonsense.
These are lies. Correct. I think I actually respect what he's doing. We talk a lot about how Pep Guardiola's message goes stale at places, and it's why he has a shelf life of roughly 4 years, no matter where he goes, no matter how successful a reign he has, because he's intense, he's in your face, we've played clips. Guys, like, that's him 24/7.
Relax and drink water.
And that will, you know, you'll love it for a while, but when you start to hit a rough patch, it will become difficult to fight through that. So I wonder if this is Pep on the fly trying to reframe his team and trying to bring in new managerial tactics. There's been no doubt as to what City have been over the last several years. They are the top dogs of this league, and they have had to kind of like move forth as being that. He is now, I think, trying to instill within them the idea that no, you are now the underdog. And I think this is a new approach by him, and it's a new mindset that a lot of these players are probably having to wrap their minds around, and I think Pep wants to see them embrace the idea of being the underdog and being the team that's now, they all believe that you're done. Your time is over. You can't compete with these clubs. He's even telling them, you're not Barcelona. You're not Real Madrid. He's trying to make these players angry.
Maybe he'll.
I respect what he's doing.
Maybe he'll show them the video that I watched at the weekend because I'm sad and I have no friends and no life. I was cleaning in the apartment and I put on a documentary from like 1980, 81 about, it's called City. And it goes inside Manchester City as they're second from bottom in the first division and about to be relegated. Maybe he'll start showing them that video. This is what you are. Relax and drink water and watch City. Because you have no friends.
Last note here. I do want to end on a high for Manchester United because they, to me, are more of the story here than Manchester City are. We were talking before about what's changed. Well, what's changed for United? Well, Harry Maguire had some interesting comments about that. He said this, over the last month or so, I feel like as a defender, I look at the forwards and think they're going to score goals. At the start of the season, we didn't really score more than one goal in a game, but now I think it's a few games on the spin where we're back to scoring goals. They're a big threat. They're top players, great talent, and I think it's all coming together now. That's an interesting tact for a young defender to take and say, hey, guy, like he's essentially saying, we're doing our job back here and we have been since day one. It's you guys up front that are suddenly starting to score goals and that's why we're winning. Now, he says it, but he's not wrong. He's not wrong.
I'm sure the forwards are looking back down the field and saying, well, you conceded two at home to Aston Villa.
That's
so,
true.
You know.
That's true. But here's the deal. In the league so far this season, United have scored two or more in five straight games in their most recent five. In those games, they've won three and they've drawn two, so they're unbeaten. Meanwhile, in the 11 games before that, they scored two or more just twice. They won three overall, they drew four, and they lost three. So, like, when they, all it takes, like, what Harry Maguire says kind of rings true. Just score two goals, and we're not going to lose. And, like, you do see that in their most recent run of these five where they're unbeaten. One other weird thing about Manchester United this year, like you said, they have the weird Aston Villa games, Crystal Palace.
Sheffield United.
Yeah. But if you're talking
Norwich.
About like the big clubs of England, they're phenomenal. So far, they've played City, Spurs, Liverpool, Chelsea, and Arsenal one time each. They're unbeaten in those games with wins over City, Spurs, and Chelsea and draws with Liverpool and Arsenal.
And it could be because those are elite derbies. They're all derbies in the sense that these are big matchups.
Yeah.
And I guess I suppose it's easier to focus the mind in those kind of games, and it's easier to prepare a team for those games than it is to go against a team you're expected to beat based on the reputation that you've had over 30 years under Alex Ferguson.
I haven't read it yet. It only just appeared on ESPN FC, so I don't know anything that Mark Ogden wrote.
Oh, it's supposed to be great.
But he wrote something here suggesting that maybe United, let me find the exact way that it's phrased here. The headline says, Man United's Paul Pogba is back from injury, but does Ole Gunnar Solskjaer even need him?
Well, I haven't read it. I don't know what Mark comes up with. He's done a brilliant piece, by the way, on the decline of United that everyone should read. It's a longer piece, and it's forensic in its depth. It's very good. I'll just say right now, because we've got loads to get to, so we need to move off this. But I will just say that I would not play him. The guy wants out. He will disrupt that midfield in the way that he plays. There's beginning to be the semblance of a union there. If you are moving him on in the summer...
Well, the thing is, who are you taking out? Like you mentioned Fred and McTominay.
Who deserves to come out of that?
I mean, unless...
You know what? Off the bench if you're losing, bring him in. Seriously, World Cup winning captain from...
This is... Yeah, I look forward to reading that. It's up on ESPN FC right now if you want to take a look.
But look, I'm very cold on Pogba the best of times. Yeah. Lukewarm on him, I would say.
By the way, unfortunately, this match was marred by an ugly incident late in which an object was thrown at Fred while he was getting ready to attempt a corner kick, and then some racist abuse was hurled at him as well.
It's caught on camera. It was clear for everyone to see. I think there's going to be police proceedings with that.
Well, I think one of the important things here is the response. Now, obviously greater, I don't know the full response yet. I assume this fan will be banned for life from attending games.
Yeah, you would hope so.
But as part of the immediate response, the fan was arrested. Pep sought out Fred right afterwards, I assume as part of some sort of apology, and just, I do think those things are important for immediate optics. Because sometimes we talk about this stuff happening in other countries and, in Eastern European nations and places like that where Italy, where we almost seem to normalize it now and act in Western society, this would never fly. Well, that's ignorant on our part because it's very prevalent in Western society and Western culture as well. But what's important is the response. And when you see immediate response like this, and I assume what will ultimately be an even stronger response, then, the hope is that it sends the immediate message that this stuff doesn't fly here.
I probably need to apologize for something I said last week. I said, I'm so tired by this stuff. And then I was online and I saw a guy we both know and a guy I've worked with in the past, Aaron West, he's African-American. Can you imagine how he tweeted, shake my head, I am so tired by all of this. Yeah. Imagine how tired he is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have a right to be tired. We should just continue. I know it's tough, but we should continue just to keep calling this stuff out. That's the best thing we can do.
Yeah.
And not be tired by it. Gary Neville had some interesting comments about the climate in the UK that might have had a role to play in this.
Jamie mentions about it being a societal problem. It absolutely is, because you're watching the Prime Minister's debate last night where a Prime Minister's talking about basically migration into this country and people coming into this country and having to have a certain level. It fuels it all the time. And essentially it's something that's got worse in the last 3 years in this country, not just in football. I think Jamie's right on that.
Yeah, I think, I'm not saying that this stuff existed before Brexit, but it's as if that vote has kind of just opened the floodgates for everyone, not everyone, but for lots of people to say or to act. And again, I feel, actually, you know what? I feel like even talking about the political climate, which he should do, Gary Neville's quite right to do that, there is no excuse for this guy. There are reasons.
I mean,
there are context. But what he did was, that's the first thing he goes to,
Yeah.
That's
I mean, look, this stuff existed before Brexit. It exists since. We had John Barnes in studio with us for half an hour earlier this year, and he said this has been a societal problem. This is not a football problem. It's societal.
He played through it in the 1980s.
Yeah.
It's so jarring to see it on TV.
So hopefully, whatever strong response there's been so far, hopefully that only multiplies and it sends the right message, which is that there's obviously no place for this. Unfortunately, we'll get to Tottenham shortly, but it happened with Son as well, where a 13-year-old Burnley fan was ejected for making some sort of racist gesture towards Son. When you see a 13-year-old doing it, that so clearly hammers home, because a 13-year-old doesn't have any kind of world experience where he's developed any kind of actual political views one way or another. That's learned behavior.
Yeah.
That's something that he saw the guy in the bleachers next to him doing. And so now he's going to do it too because he thinks that's what you do at a game.
Right.
That's why you have to get rid of this stuff. It's not for the generation now, not to sound cold or cynical, but that's a lost, like that's lost. If you're a 55-year-old guy doing this stuff, that's who you are.
Yeah.
But it's for the next generation. So football fans in 20 and 30 years are going to games and don't have to deal with this, and players don't have to deal with it in the generations to come. That's learned behavior. And you see 13-year-olds, That's the stuff that scares me more than seeing middle-aged guys doing it.
Absolutely. And again, when you're on the terraces or when you're together, you know, with a bunch of fans and there's an excitement and a buzz about being this group, especially if you're away from home, there's, you know, the chants, everybody sings along together. There is a kind of a herd mentality.
Yeah.
And certainly if you're someone who's young and easily influenced, that thing you end up doing something that you have not thought through.
That's exactly it. That's right. So we'll monitor that and we'll follow up and talk about whatever the punishment does wind up being. And hopefully it meets whatever standard you and I have kind of set for it in our mind. We continue now, JJ. Everton. God, if there was ever a club that needed a day like that. And it was the 7:30 a.m. game too. So if it went badly, they just would have to stew in it all weekend. But no, instead it's Chelsea who have to do the stewing as Everton get that classic, I would say, new manager bounce. I don't even know if you consider Duncan Ferguson a new manager. He doesn't even consider himself a new manager.
But he's been there in the background for the past few years, since like 2014, I think, sitting there glowering on the bench and a much more passive figure than the guy who went around headbutting people and pulling people around, the physical, violent essence of the dunk. Duncan Ferguson, Duncan Disorderly, the guy who became an Everton legend. And it was Duncan unleashed, not in a negative way, running down the sideline, punching the air afterwards, doing a full kind of almost full, it's center the field, clapping all four stands at Goodison, pumping his fists.
The man is running around England just looking for ball kids to hug.
Oh my God.
Just like picking up one after another.
It was just an injection of Everton DNA back into the building and into the team. He went 4-4-2, Andrew. 4-4-2.
Old faithful.
Two wingers, two centre forwards. Just look at the first goal. Look at the first goal. The first goal is the epitome of 4-4-2. The centre forward, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, drops off. Plays a 1-2 with Richarlison, who spins it out wide to Sidibe. Sidibe puts a cross in and bang, header home. This is a goal that exists. If you were to cut Duncan Ferguson's arm and let him bleed and then do serious analysis of that blood, within that blood is that goal. How many goals like that, exact goals like that, has he scored at that end for Everton?
So you think his chromosomes align in some sort of 4-4-2 figuration?
No, I think what he did was, like some kind of mad Scottish Tony Robbins, he, with the strength of his will and his belief, inspired a Brazilian man to be Duncan Ferguson, 1995.
This was so needed for them, and even more than that, what you're talking about right now, scoring a goal in the fifth minute, that more than anything felt like it was so needed for them, where like there wasn't even enough time for like seeds of doubt to creep in.
No. Now look, Chelsea, in terms of their defending and the next two goals, did not cover themselves in any kind of glory.
Well, Kepa's pass.
I don't know what he was thinking, but look at that midfield. And this would be the concern for Chelsea. A midfield with two wingers and only two central midfielders, Schneiderlin and Sigurdsson. Got the upper hand on Chelsea. That's a worry. I mean, Michael Goodman tweeted beforehand, he thought it was an insane lineup by Duncan Ferguson. I didn't like the idea of insane. The idea that a guy who's got all the badges he has and played as much as he had and understands the DNA of the club would do something that's insane. But he was fair to point out that a four-man midfield might struggle against what Chelsea are bringing. And yet, that magical day, it was just unbelievable. And again, I'm a broken record on this. Everton, you cannot leave Goodison Park. Abandon the stadium plans. Redevelop Goodison Park. That place is an iconic place. It's up there with the Westfalenstadion and Anfield and Old Trafford and anywhere else you want to talk about.
Yeah, but it's, well,
let's not go down that
road. No, I don't want to right now. But yeah, it was a performance that they so badly needed to kind of just like everyone can breathe again a little bit. There's a little bit of room. They move up to 14th, right. So there's at least some. They don't see themselves in the bottom three, and they're not a bottom.
And they're
we've said that repeatedly. This is not, say what you want about the talent on this team. There's enough talent there where they should be at least hovering around 10th.
But this is to begin a run of games which will be grueling. And
well, that run started 2 weeks ago. They're in the thick of that run
right now.
They're actually now off. Like down the other side, although now you throw in the FA Cup fixture against Liverpool in the third round.
But still, I mean, if you look at it for Everton, it's a shot in the arm. I mean, it's all ethereal. If you're asking me, can they go on and keep putting in these kind of performances? I don't know. They might have to do something a little bit different. We'll see how flexible Duncan Ferguson is. What was interesting to me was his press conference. I've started watching a lot of manager press conferences, by the way, but his was
riveting.
Not always, but he came in and instead of the kind of archetypal Irving Welsh character that I remember from his playing days, he was nervous, he was excited, but he said something and he repeated it, which was interesting. He was asked about how are the players after Marco Silva's sacking, and he said, mixed emotions. And I was like, mixed emotions? So clearly the dressing room was divided, that there were some players fully in on Silva and some not at all.
That should be surprising to no one,
It does surprise me. And it surprises me that, because don't forget Duncan Ferguson was part of the coaching staff. It does surprise me a little bit. I just thought the problem at Everton was that he couldn't get, results out of this team. I didn't think that he had necessarily lost the faith of the players in the way that he clearly had.
When a team is struggling like that, trust me, the locker room is not united behind that manager.
Okay, all right. Maybe
I think that's always going to be the case.
He kept saying mixed emotions, and I just found that
interesting. Maybe what's surprising is that Duncan Ferguson would reveal that, but that doesn't surprise me in any way to hear that Everton could be playing that poorly and there would be guys in there who aren't on board with what's going on.
But to have an aggressive character, like,
the fan base certainly needs it.
They're going to get behind him, right? And you could be in a Solskjaer situation if results go well.
Which, I was thinking the same thing.
Which will be a huge burden on his shoulders.
And if he continue, now he, by his own, what was most interesting about his press conference.
He said he doesn't want it.
No, he says like, this is a job for top tier managers I am not that man.
Correct.
Which is, it's very humble.
But when you see how Everton have just like lurched from one flavor of the month, Koeman, to another, Silva, to a fixer, Allardyce, maybe they want the consistency of just a guy, and maybe Duncan Ferguson is just a guy.
They are, if this continues and they continue to eke out, draws against good sides, beat some teams that they're supposed to beat, and he continues to, and I don't mean this in a bad way, it's going to sound like that, he continues to carry on this way every time they score a goal, and the fan base is going to love it. They're going to eat this up. And if I'm reading now at Sky Sports website that Everton have approached Unai Emery. So what is this fan base? Like, you are setting this next manager up to just come in and meet the wrath of a fan base that is not going to want you. If this club legend continues to get results and inspire a fan base and the team the way that he is, and then he takes a backseat to someone like Unai Emery, who I'm sure talked to 10 Everton fans right now, and I guarantee you all 10 will say no thanks.
No. I think Everton fans would go for a young manager with a good CV rather than an older manager now who's failed at Arsenal. And failed, not just failed like failed in another country, failed visibly in front of their eyes at Arsenal. Mm-hmm. That would, I think you're so right on that. What I'm fascinated is the first time Duncan Ferguson gets angry. What, like, is the old Dunk still in there? Or is this like a reformed character?
Does this look like a reformed character?
But when the tie during the game was disheveled and he was just like, he commanded that technical area.
It was fun. It was a fun watch, unless you're a Chelsea fan.
I'm a Liverpool fan. I found it fun.
Let's see, JJ. Leicester City, we move on to them now because they cannot stop winning. What a week it was for them as they ink their manager to a new long-term contract. They win for
long-term, guys.
And we all know how important long-term contracts are and how meaningful they are.
This definitely isn't them making sure that they get lots of money in the summer when he eventually goes to Arsenal.
Wow. Wow. And not only that, they win for a club record 8th straight time. By the way, the previous record was not even from their title-winning season. It was actually from the 62-63 season. But 8 straight wins for them. The star of the match, once again, Jamie Vardy, who, for however good he was when they won the title, it seems like he's even found a new gear. Like, I think we all thought that Jamie Vardy would kind of like tail off a
little bit.
And he sort of did. His production has never been poor.
So did Leicester, though.
Yeah, his production has never been poor. He's maintained a standard, but he's now like come back with a vengeance under this manager. Two goals over the weekend. He now has a league-leading 16 goals in the league this season. That's five more than the next closest player, which is Tammy Abraham, who has 11.
He's an elite striker. An elite striker, and has been for some years. I will next week, because I'm thoroughly unprepared. I do not have the stats about him versus Ronaldo and versus other people in terms of goal scoring in this league, but he is out head and shoulders ahead of a lot of players in terms of goals over a certain period.
Well, this will shed a little bit of light on that. His 16 goals that he has right now are tied for third most in Premier League history through 16 match days. That's amazing. And the most by a Premier League player since Luis Suarez had 17 at this point in the 13-14 season. So this is what we're talking about.
So now there are key players in this side, key players in the midfield, key players, Johnny Evans, Sancho, Chilwell, Pereira. There's key players around this team. But going forward, I don't think they could afford to lose Jamie Vardy. Like that is the one guy, because the drop off to Iosi Perez or the next striker,
Iheanacho, who's now scoring goals for fun too.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Iheanacho, 14, he's like a bus. 14 months without a bus, along comes the Iheanacho bus.
Yeah.
Two of them together. Yeah. They're good. There's no question.
Yeah. So I have a question here for you.
Right.
It's probably too early to do this, but I can't help it.
It's a fun question.
Because of where they are on the table, can you make an argument that this Leicester team, who, let's be honest, however good they are, they're not going to win the title because Liverpool are operating on a different...
We don't know that yet, but go,
it's over.
Go on.
The season's over.
It's not. It's December. Go on.
But can you make an argument that this Leicester City team is actually better than the one that won the title?
So let's go from the goalkeeper. Goalkeeper's the same.
Right.
I think the goalkeeper's got better. I actually think he has got better.
Okay.
Over the years. Take the back four. Chilwell and Pereira versus Simpson and Fuchs. I'm taking Chilwell and Pereira.
Same.
Center backs. Soyuncu and Evans versus Huth and Morgan. I'm taking Soyuncu and Evans.
See, I wouldn't. I would take Huth and Morgan. Don't let your mind be poisoned by what Wes Morgan became after that season.
But what was he beforehand? And what was Robert Huth beforehand?
Like, in that season,
the center back pairing was so improbable. A guy who barely, I mean, he just was a journeyman in Huth, really didn't get his game at Chelsea, and then ends up having this amazing season. And Wes Morgan, who was a player, who was a championship player for most of his career.
Huth and Morgan was the best centre-back pairing in the league that year.
Now here's where things get difficult, because we'll say Albrighton, Kante, Drinkwater, Mahrez, Tielemans and Didi, Madison, we'll throw into that mix as well. Mm-hmm. Kante is such a good player.
Yeah.
Midfield wise, I'm taking the 15-16 midfield.
I think I am too. The problem is we saw N'Golo Kante then leave and go somewhere else and continue to be that. Like, I mean, he might have been the best player on the team that won a World Cup.
Wasn't he PFA player of the year back-to-back seasons?
Right. It's hard for our minds to not be like diluted with thoughts of that. Like, we don't know. James Maddison may leave Leicester. And then he may go somewhere else, and he may be like what, you know, have the impact that Conte has. But it's just hard to know.
Someone can come up with some stats for me that Madison is outperforming what Mahrez did for Leicester. But I'm not having it. I'm not swapping Mahrez for Madison in 15-16 Mahrez for current Madison. No, I'm not doing that. And up front, Jamie Vardy.
It has to be a wash, right?
There's no combination. Vardy and Iheanacho versus...
Iosi Perez has had an okay season. It's going to take time for him to...
I mean, Vardy being the constant in there.
Yeah.
Drinkwater and Kante versus Ndidi and Tielemans. Drinkwater and Kante, I think, for me. But again, I don't like this revisionism because they played in such a different... They had a style that suited what they had in 15-16, and they executed it they got the absolute maximum out of that team.
Yeah.
And this is a team that is better funded and better, you know, has been built differently.
The better
don't
funding.
Don't forget.
You're right, though. This team can only exist because of guys like N'Golo Kanté and Riyad Mahrez and the money that they, like Yuri Tielemans, players like that are probably not able to come here if Leicester don't have the money from that season.
And it's not like Leicester were an established Premier League team when they won the league. I mean, they were nearly relegated the season before under Nigel Pearson. It's an interesting pub question,
yeah.
though.
Yeah. Let's see. Elsewhere around the league, just a couple quick things, JJ. Speaking of teams that can't stop winning, Liverpool, they rolled yet again. Mohamed Salah, I believe, has now scored 63 goals in his first 100 Premier League games, which is something like sixth most through 100 games in the league.
Absolutely brilliant. And set up a goal as well for Keita with just the most audacious backheel. Keita looked good in that game as well. I think when Bournemouth lost, not that Liverpool weren't going to win the game, because you have to, the way Liverpool play now, you have to trust that eventually they are going to eke out the win in some fashion. And they did it with style in the end, but when Nathan Ake went off for Bournemouth, you felt that was it, you know?
A team that already struggles in defence, and when they lose a guy who is, I think, unanimously considered to be their best defender.
Minutes later, it's a brilliant ball over the top by Henderson for Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, and there's the goal. Liverpool were very, very good in this game. Even though maybe, you know, Bournemouth kept them out for a while, but look, this team don't panic at all. They keep playing the way that the manager wants them to play, and eventually they reap the rewards. And it was just the same at the Vitality at the weekend.
I think the problem with Liverpool that I've been thinking about is that, like when we talk about Manchester City, I think we know peak City, what that looks like. Now, it's hard to stop, but I think if you're trying to defend against them, you kind of know what you're up against. When I ask you to tell me, like, what defines this Liverpool team, I don't even know what I would say, because I feel like they're capable of beating you in every way imaginable.
If we're having a tough game, can't get through you, we are set-piece masters. We've scored a ton of goals from set pieces. We can play balls over the top. We can play diagonals. We can ping it into Firmino, as evidenced against Newcastle, and he can unlock something.
They're lethal on the counterattack.
So many different elements to the team right now that have all been developed by Jurgen Klopp, and it's masterful.
Yep. Let's see. Tottenham back on track after the slip up against Manchester United. Five goals against Burnley. Tottenham have, I think their last couple now, they've really succeeded against Burnley, whereas others, that sometimes is a team that
did not see anything except the Sun goal. Oh, I saw the Kane goal, and I saw the Sun goal.
The Sun goal was awesome. We talk a lot on the show about what our favorite type of goal is. Is it just like a 40-yard blast, or is it a mazy run? I don't know. I can't even answer that question anymore. I don't know. This goal was awesome. It started at the edge of his own box, and it ended with him scoring a goal without anyone else touching it. He's dribbling through guys. He's blowing past other guys. Burnley players are just left helpless behind him. This was a really fun goal.
If you've seen the O.J. Simpson chase down the highway where Simpson is in the white Bronco, if you've seen it, everyone's seen it. So Simpson's in the white Bronco with
Al Cowlings,
and he's driving along, and behind is like 12, 11 police cars, whatever.
Yeah.
That's what Son is like. He's just, everybody's in his wake. You didn't see that comparison coming, did you?
No. I don't even know if it's apt. I don't know if it's appropriate, quite frankly, but it is. And one other thing, JJ, I was looking at some of the results over the weekend, and it just got me wondering about who you would consider the biggest surprise of the season to be right now. And I'm going to remove Leicester City from that, because we can go back and listen to our preview show, but we said we believe Leicester would be competing for a top four place.
Yes.
So, look, am I surprised they've won eight straight? Yeah, kind of, but I'm not surprised that Leicester are in the conversation of where they are right now. I'm thinking more along the lines of, like, Newcastle or Sheffield. Really, Sheffield United is probably the answer to this, but I'm curious what you would say.
Can I only pick one?
No, there's no rules here.
All right. It's
like Outback Steakhouse. No rules, just right.
So I will go with, by the way, we need to get sponsorship off them if you're going to use that. Thanks. Newcastle. I'm going to say Newcastle based on the doom and gloom. Like it's, I know Jonjo Shelvey and things like that, you know, scoring over the last few weeks and things like that have kind of brought a new fizz to the team. But
right. If
you think of the general bad mood, ill-tempered feeling of the fans when Steve Bruce got the job. It's, I won't say it's remarkable, and it is only early December, but it's been much better than we could have thought, although I still say there's always the 5-1 or 5-0 thrashing, whatever they got against Leicester. It's going to happen at some point. For me, it's Sheffield United because of the way they play. They play really good football, and I remember Danny Mills got pilloried for it. He came in and clearly, I mean, we've had Danny on the show, but he clearly didn't watch Sheffield United last season. And he just said they'll be tough, they'll be compact, they'll play the long ball, things like that, you know. That's literally not what they do.
Right.
And
I think it's just like playing off of like...
Well, they've come up, they're going to get battered, they're going to park the bus kind of mentality. And they haven't done that. They've been a joy to watch. Overlapping centre-backs. You know, it's great. It's great to see. And I also think that Graham Potter at Brighton deserves a lot of praise just for the simple reason is that he's playing a style that's totally different to what Steve Bruce has done. He's been brave enough to rejig that back line. He's dropped one of the best defenders in the league over the last two seasons, which was Shane Duffy. Just dropped him. And, he hasn't been afraid to go with youth, playing Aaron Connolly up front. And I think he made some decisions, like I said, sending players on loan that I wasn't sure about, creative players on loan, but it's worked out so far.
Yeah, Sheffield, look, ultimately, I think Sheffield United is probably the answer to this question, but I did want to mention the club that you just mentioned as my answer, and that's Brighton, just because they didn't really do anything in the summer.
No, they let players go, if anything.
I mean, I don't know. To me, they kind of looked like a dead-on shot to be going down. They've won 5 games already this season. That's more than Arsenal have won.
And we said... you certainly said it, that it was a mistake. Not a mistake, but it was harsh on Chris Hughton to get fired last year after keeping them up. Well, maybe it was the time for a change, and that change has been good for them.
Yeah. But, like, you just... I don't know. They're one of these clubs that I look at. Like, they beat Tottenham 3-0. They beat Arsenal. They beat Everton. And then you look at their team sheet, and you're like, how are they doing this exactly? So, yeah, you have to give the manager a lot of credit. And then, like, you know, Neil Maupay has 6 goals for Brighton. Like, who?
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. It's just like a team of kind of anonymous guys, and here they are, like comfortably. Well, no one's really comfortable, but solidly mid-table right now.
Yeah, you're right. I agree with that.
Yeah. All right. So there you go. Hopefully that kind of like quells the people who are upset that we don't talk about any teams except for like a select few. You people, I'll tell you. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break. When we come back, there's a big what to watch for because the Champions League group stage is culminating on Tuesday and Wednesday, so we got to just kind of give you like the refresher on what's at stake as quickly as we can. Sometimes that's so tedious and boring, you know, like they got to do if this happens and that happens and this happens and they get this result, then you don't want to hear all too much of that, but you got to know a little bit. So we'll help you out with that. Mailbag, lots to do. Don't go anywhere.
I chose not to choose life. I chose something else.
Sinibe's ball in, and Richarlison is Duncan Ferguson's Everton, the perfect start. 4.5 minutes gone, an instant response from those in blue.
Oh, back now on our Everton dance party. Look at you pumping your fist. What a bro you are at heart.
Oh, yeah. Choose Life from the Trainspotting soundtrack.
Yeah. One of your favorite movies that is often referenced on this podcast.
Absolutely, yeah. And they have some good commentary about being Scottish as well.
Doesn't make you proud to be Scottish? It's being Scottish!
Not for Duncan Ferguson this weekend.
No, certainly not. Let's see, JJ, you've got a big, healthy mailbag here.
@SuaSoccerPod, @CaughtOffsideESPN on the Instagrams, CaughtOffsidePod@gmail.com. Please... leave us a review on iTunes also, but get in contact with us via those outlets. We love hearing from you. Well, I do. Andrew doesn't.
That's a lie.
Patrick, question for the mailbag. What has happened to clubs like Bury this year and historically great clubs like Man United and Arsenal struggling to be even shells of their former selves? Is this just part of some sort of cycle clubs go through, or is it something deeper? With the large influx of money over recent years, are owners now overlooking the history, fabric and quality of their clubs in favour of the almighty dollar? First of all, just to get Bury out of the way, which is kind of what the English Football League did with them, Bury's decline is probably being fueled by the interest and the money all heading towards the Premier League and bad ownership. The decline of Manchester United and Arsenal is probably more cyclical. You know, United were on top for 30-something years, or close to it anyway, 25, 26 years. And Arsenal have consistently been a good side. But, you know, Arsenal in the 80s, they went through a bit of a slump where they didn't win leagues and they were kind of struggling. I would say that's more cyclical. And also, money in the league has meant that teams like Leicester can now aspire to bring in the kind of players, your Tielemans, your Ndidis, into the sides to bolster them and push them forward. At the five jack, I've been sitting here and thinking, who is the best character, Alfie Solomon or Aberama Gold from Peaky Blinders, Andrew? Really tough call. Your thoughts?
Both tremendous characters, and the two that I would have picked out as well if I was like power ranking like your like other players on the show.
Yeah.
Alfie Solomon's for me.
Yeah.
Like in all television, when he is on camera, you cannot take your eyes off
of
that guy.
You have to listen to every word. He's perfectly acted by Mr. Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
At Sunny SoCal Rob put us. Oh, by the way, before I get to At Sunny SoCal Rob, people are asking what show you were referring to. You can say it. When I left the room and you went on your rant, I didn't even listen to that yet. I don't even know what it was about.
No, I don't want you to.
Okay, but you want to say what show it is?
I don't want to ruin it. All right, spoiler alert for anybody who's watching TV right now and afraid that I was talking about your show. I'm going to say it in 3, 2, 1. The Man in the High Castle.
Okay. At Sunny SoCal Rob, after sharing your thoughts on the Euro 2020 draw, a shambles, I will hope you spare a moment on the Copa America draw that just happened on the next pod, surely. Rob links us to a Tim Vickery article on ESPN. It was a bizarre draw for a bizarre competition. 12 nations are taking part in next year's Copa America because, don't forget, Copa America is now moving to even years.
When does this thing happen?
It must happen all the time. Next year they'll move to odd years, meaning there'll be...
It's its own league. You have South American players, they play for their club teams. Then that season ends, then they have their Copa America season, and then that ends, then they go back to their club teams and back to Copa America and so on.
10 of these teams, the South American countries, already knew the group they would be part of. Tuesday night's ceremony in Cartagena then was mainly to define the destiny of the two invited teams, with Australia drawn in the southern group while Qatar went to the north. The 2020 Copa America is a product of political divisions. The tournament is taking place every because the four-year cycle of the Copa is changing from odd to even years. So Brazil staged the tournament in June and July this year and won it on home soil. The next Copa will be in Ecuador in 2024. And the South American authorities have taken advantage of the switch to squeeze in another version in June and July of next year. But where would that take place? Well, basically the two front runners were Argentina and Colombia. So they needed to figure out which one of these should get it. So a classic compromise was agreed. The 2020 Copa America will be shared between Argentina and Colombia. Two nations at the opposite ends of South America. A six-hour flight separates the two capitals. The co-sharing arrangement has serious repercussions on the organization of the tournament. Traditionally, the Copa America features three of groups of four. This is not viable for 2020. Instead, each country will have a group. Argentina will host the countries of the South, Uruguay, Paraguay, Chile, Bolivia, joined, as we learned on Tuesday night, by Australia. Colombia has the North, Brazil, big enough to fit into either region, along with Ecuador, Peru and Venezuela, and Qatar have been placed in with them. In this format, each team will play 5 group games and the group phase eliminates just 4 of the 12 teams. There are still quarterfinal, semifinals and a final to play. The finalists of a 32-team World Cup plays 7 games in the course of a competition, while the finalists of this 12-team 2020 Copa America will play 8.
These are a lot of words.
A lot of words. Sorry, but it's just a mess.
Can I just dumb it down and bring it back to a more American-centric? This tournament is sneaky fun for the American fan, because if you sit down and watch this, there will be names that appear that you'll be like, wait a minute, I know him. Like, ever since MLS has kind of made its shift in policy, not policy, but like it's this idea that instead of just going after veteran high profile European guys, we're actually going to try and find some like young rising star South American players. Like, you'll now watch this tournament and you'll see that those guys are littered all throughout this.
Yeah.
Which is fun. Like, you know, obviously, like, you know, we know about Ladero and Raul Ruiz Diaz and guys like that, and Miguel Almiron, Joseph Martinez, but, you know, even like Brian Rodriguez, young player for LAFC, you see him on Uruguay. Like, it's, I would just say, MLS fans, if you watch this tournament, you will find yourself enjoying it more than you might think because of the guys you recognize.
I would also say that teams that will be at the business end of this tournament in 2020, in the summer 2020, watch those players and their drop-off then for their European clubs, because this seems like it will be a grueling tournament with travel, seeing as they have a North and South division. CMoose2 wants our thoughts on this. So let me explain this quickly. He sent us a screenshot of something that has been posted by an account called So Funny Soccer. They have 85,000 followers.
Mm.
Okay. So Funny Soccer have themselves tweeted a screen, posted an Instagram screenshot of a tweet that is reacting to Megan Rapinoe getting the Ballon d'Or.
Okay.
And it's by Depressed Milan Fan. And he says this. She played a total of 6 games for her club in 2019. 6 games. Let that sink in. She then scored 3 penalties from the 6 goals she scored in the 5 matches she played at the World Cup. Bronze and Lavelle, Lucy Bronze and Rose Lavelle, have been absolutely robbed from this political award. So then, So Funny Soccer thinks this is a good post, that's why they're posting it, and they've written, not going to lie, I think this is pretty dead on. Rapinoe stepped up when she needed to for her country in the World Cup, but she wouldn't have gotten anywhere close to this award if it wasn't for the politics of it. If the award is actually given to the best player in the world, this decision is garbage. What do you guys think? Comment. So Seamus, or Seamus rather, wants us to give a, to give our thoughts on this. Well, first of all, the tweet itself is incorrect. It's saying that that Rose Lavelle and Lucy Bronze have been robbed. Well, let's just take Lavelle. The first thing to point out is Lavelle only played 6 games this season as well in the NWSL. Lucy Bronze played 3 times that amount for her club in both the Champions League and the French League combined, 19 games. So it's not on your, it's not going to be on your club status. The women's Ballon d'Or will, in a World Cup year, is not going to be voted for on what you did for your club. And,
but the fact that people are now mentioning that, I think, is actually a promising shift in the way the women's game is viewed.
Well,
that it's now being viewed as not just an international game. Now, like what you do for your club matters more and should be more of a factor in a decision like this. So I actually kind of, I actually think that's a positive shift in thinking.
I think that there should be more focus on the domestic leagues. I think it benefits all of women's soccer.
The problem is the World Cup interrupts the domestic leagues.
Right, exactly. And so will the Olympics in the summer. So that is a problem too. But, you know, people don't like Megan Rapinoe. Lots of people don't like Megan Rapinoe. Lots of people love her. Lots of people think everything she does is politically motivated. So, you know, they're going to have this view on it. I just think it's a little bit unfair because we know in a World Cup year, for a women's World Cup year, that's the way things are going to be adjudicated. But look at Modric for the Ballon d'Or. I mean, the World Cup heavily swayed his...
Definitely.
Now, he was very good for Real Madrid, but still, the world that was the that pushed him over the top in getting that award, too. So it's not that different.
Yeah, I don't necessarily have a problem with, the in a World Cup year, the best player on the best team walking away with the award. So if you think that's Megan Rapinoe, then I'm okay. Like, regardless of how she scored her goals from the penalty spot or not, I think it's a little too simplistic to say, oh, 3 of her goals were penalties, therefore she couldn't have been the best player for the U.S. in that tournament. That's nonsense. If you watch the game, she was phenomenal for the U.S. Now,
and Ada Hegerberg won the award last year when it was based on what? Her Champions League.
Right. Now, look, me personally, I said this last week. When we talked about it, I walked away from the tournament thinking that the best player on the best team in the World Cup was Rose Lavelle.
Which is fine.
Right, but like...
But you can't put her out here. It's a bit thoughtless to me to attack Rapinoe for exactly what you... You think Lavelle should get it over her? She's not robbed. They did exactly the same thing. Uh-huh. You'd have exactly the same problem if Rose Lavelle won it.
Yeah.
That's my point. And finally, a few of you had pointed this out to us. This is from CNN. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, has unanimously agreed to ban Russia from major international sporting competitions, notably the Olympics and the World Cup. So that'll be the Qatar World Cup, for 4 years over doping non-compliance. WADA's Compliance Review, CRC, committee had suggested several sanctions because of the Russian anti-doping agency's RUSADA's failure to cooperate fully during probes into Russian sport. WADA's executive committee decided to uphold the recommendations at a meeting in Lausanne, Switzerland on Monday. Russia, I believe, have 21 days to take this, to take their appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So that is Russia out of the Qatar World Cup, but not out, curiously, not out of Euro 2020, as WADA does not consider UEFA.
And says I'll read it for you. It says here, Euro 2020 is not recognized by WADA as a major event. Someone's going to have to explain to me what qualifies as a major event. Therefore, what? Russia will still be able to take part in the competition, where its St. Petersburg Stadium is set to host several games, including a quarterfinal.
So the cross-continental the largest European championships ever in terms of teams and scale is not a big event. To crown the best team in Europe is not a big event.
I don't know. I suppose this sounds like
kicking the can down the road, because it would cause major consternation to rule them out of this now, 6 months out from a tournament.
Maybe they could just lean on the idea that WADA oversees world events, World Cups, World Championships, Olympics. This is maybe viewed by them as a regional event, which is taken care of by its own regional governing body.
Pretty huge region.
I would agree. I think that's silliness, but you know, that's what they'll tell you. Is that it?
That's the mailbag. Please.
That was great.
Contact us. Follow us on the social medias, Andrew. You know, the kids are really into the social medias.
I've heard that. I've heard that Snapchat is coming back. That was a thing I was never into, and I thought it had disappeared.
I can't imagine you sending a snap.
I actually don't know how it works. I've never even had that on my
Take a picture, you send it, it expires.
Well, yeah, I know what it is, but I don't know how you, like, I don't know.
It's very easy. You download the app.
Already lost interest.
And then you press.
Don't care.
Wow.
Don't care. What to watch for? This is just Champions League only. Eight places are still up for grabs heading into match day six. So eight teams are through. Eight more are to be decided. Here's a real quick refresher, basically, of where we're at. Tuesday, 12:55, Red Bull Salzburg versus Liverpool. A Liverpool loss will knock them out.
Yeah. This is this is something.
Yeah.
Jesse
and
March,
by the way, it's not being played at Anfield.
It's incredible. I thought both legs of this game would be at Anfield because of the way.
I know.
Crazy. Jesse Marsh stands on the precipice of glory, knocking out the reigning European champions with his little rinky-dink Salzburg side.
Can you name the last time the reigning European champions did not make it through the group stage?
I can't, but I know Liverpool didn't in 2005-06.
It's happened more recently than that.
Oh, it has?
And it does involve an English club.
Ooh, Chelsea.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
Yeah, we went out in 2005-06. We played Benfica, was it, at Anfield? Didn't get out of the group, Andrew.
There is precedent.
And we're against the beast.
Something tells
me. Erling Braut Haaland.
Yeah. How will Liverpool fans react to this? Because part of me feels
it hasn't happened.
But I'm saying, if it does, part of me feels like, well, they'll be okay with it because what they've been craving is the league.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm quite.
And they've just won a European Cup.
But winning is winning, and you don't want anything to interrupt the sense of serenity.
But that's the thing, is like, then I saw the reaction when Liverpool lost at Napoli early in the group stage, and I thought,
people freaked out.
Liverpool are now at a level where this fan base, rightfully so, by the way, expects them to win whatever they're involved in, and I think that's fair. Liverpool have risen to that level for me.
I want us to progress in both competitions, but I obviously want us to win the league like there's nothing else.
I know all about it. Tuesday, 3:00, Chelsea and Lille. It's a win and in situation for Chelsea.
And Chelsea coming in limping a little bit into this one.
Yeah.
But it is at the bridge.
Yes.
Where they don't play well.
At least not in the league.
Yeah.
Tuesday, also 3:00, Ajax and Valencia. Now, let's just assume, to make it easy here, that Chelsea win. Ajax will then join them with just a point.
And we want that to happen.
It's probably the most likely scenario. Chelsea at home against Lille, you would expect to win. And then Ajax at home against Valencia, you would expect them to at least be able to get a draw out of that. Let's see. Then this I kind of grouped together. Tuesday at 3, both of these, Inter versus Barcelona and Borussia Dortmund versus Slavia Prague. Inter and Dortmund are tied right now on points. But Inter has a sizable edge in terms of the tiebreaker. But Inter are playing Barcelona.
Yes.
So,
but Inter at home in the San Siro with, why do I feel like Inter can do this considering the form of Lautaro Martinez and just the general good vibes around the club?
Also, Barcelona, it's interesting because Barcelona right now on form have been actually fantastic. They're coming off a 5-2, Messi with a hat trick.
Right, but.
And Suarez with a Puskas nominee.
What a goal. It chipped backheel.
Yeah. Yeah. How?
I've watched it several times. His awareness is unbelievable. He has the quick look over the shoulder still to get it right.
It was incredible.
That he doesn't fall over his feet on the turf and look like a fool. Right now we're in the middle of it, but at a remove of a few years, we will talk about Luis Suarez in just as one of the all-time greats there with Zidane and
everyone else. They're in some form right now, but they're playing for nothing, essentially. Barcelona are through.
What does Valverde do?
I don't know, but this is the same situation that Barcelona were in last year.
Can't rest Messi.
When they played Spurs.
He's not allowed rest Messi. These are the rules.
Well,
you rest Messi, you're on the way out of the club.
They did a year ago. Messi did come on as a sub in right. that game against Tottenham. And Tottenham did get the 1-1 draw that they needed. Like I said, it's win and in. And look, you have to assume if you're Inter that Borussia Dortmund are going to take care of business against Slavia Prague.
That's a kind of a...
It's in Germany.
Tricky assumption.
It's in...
I
if
know.
If it was on the road... it's what you have to think, though.
I know, it's what you have to think, but this is a team that can, you know, routinely be 3-0 down at halftime to Paderborn.
Let's see. Tuesday at 3 o'clock in Group G. I can't go through all the permutations. Just know everything matters. Benfica play Zenit St. Petersburg and Lyon play Leipzig. And, like, I don't know how else to say it, but so many things could still happen there. Every team is still in it. Wednesday, we move to that now, 12:55, Shakhtar and Atalanta. Atalanta have probably been, if I was assigning, like, the biggest disappointment of the Champions League so far, they are a prime candidate. And it's amazing, JJ, that they're on just 4 points heading into the final match day, and they can still do it. A win for Atalanta and a win or draw for Man City over Dinamo Zagreb will see Atalanta through. And you would assume, even though Man City are playing for nothing, you do think that they should probably be able to beat or tie Dinamo Zagreb. So it's a win and in situation for Atalanta, which is not easy to do going to Shakhtar. But man, 4 points, and they can still get through into the knockout stage heading into the final match day. Wow.
They're just so open, though. I think their commitment to playing the style of football that they play has left them open, particularly to Manchester City, and they've got some wallopings, so that's part of it.
Yeah, and then finally, Wednesday at 3 o'clock, Atletico Madrid and Lokomotiv Moscow. Atletico are not through just yet. A win for Atleti will see them through and will knock Bayer Leverkusen out. And this is essential for Atletico Madrid, because their league campaign has been frustrating. Their season, it almost feels like, has been marred in some ways by the way Griezmann left and going to Barcelona and kind of the back and forth over how that went down.
And not being able to beat Olymp Barca a week ago has not sat easy with the fans.
And this is a team that typically thrives in this competition. And I don't know, this fan base will not accept going out.
Group stage exit will not go down well. However, they regard Simeone as a hero.
Oh yeah, I'm not saying it's any indictment on him. I'm just saying you're going to anger a lot of fans that will find this to be unacceptable. At home against Lokomotiv in a game you have to win, that's a game you have to win. So there you go. Hopefully that helps, because there's still a lot going on heading into the final match day of the group stage. It should be a lot of fun. We'll probably be back Thursday morning, early afternoon, with a recap of all that. So keep your eyes open for that. Should be fun, man.
This was a fun podcast.
Yeah, I know.
Glad we did it.
Yeah, me too. This is what we do.
So we're having the photo shoot then?
So I have spoken to our photographer, and I've told him to target Thursday.
So I'm going
to
just wear the most boring old shirt.
Like I've said to you from the start, you can wear whatever you want. Just tell me so we can be on the same page. That's not asking too much.
Someone said we both have to wear turtlenecks.
Yeah, maybe I've been thinking we should talk offline, but I feel like we should maybe do something fun with this.
Okay. Turtlenecks and pipes.
Let's think about it. Let's have a good long think.
All right. Okay.
All right.
Sounds
good
to me.
And then eventually people will see what we come back
Hawaiian
with.
Shirts?
I don't actually own a Hawaiian shirt. Do you?
Of course I do. The minute I saw,
everyone owns a Hawaiian shirt?
It's my summer shirt. I have two actually.
Really?
Covered in flowers. And when I sit down, I feel like Tony Soprano on vacation with Paulie when I wear one.
Nice. I know the feeling. Well, hey, this was fun, man. We'll be back later in the week with a Champions League recap. To you, I say...
Red card.
You got to leave that in.
To you, I say...
Take you later, folks.
That's what I say. See ya.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.